From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. True to form, March is coming in like a lion at the state capitol. Today marks day 25 of 40 of the session, and we're less than a week away from crossover day. That's the do-or-die time that bills pass at least one chamber and then move into the other. Here to give us a rundown of the week in politics is our own legislative lion, GPB Politics reporter Stephen Fowler.
Good morning. Just don't expect me to roar.
I'm glad you didn't. Let's start with the House Speaker, David Ralston, also a defense attorney, by the way, and he is in some hot water for allegedly abusing his position as a lawmaker. This is in connection to some of his legal cases. Now, even members of his own Republican Party are circulating a resolution calling for him to resign. Stephen, what are the details of the allegations?
So this stems from an investigation that the AJC and WSB did into some of Speaker Ralston's cases, and that he filed continuances for these cases, saying that they need to be postponed and going forward because of work that he had to do. And in some of these cases, since he's a defense attorney, some of the people are accused of things like DUI, child enticement, you know, not good things. And these trials haven't happened, or some of these cases haven't been resolved for years in some cases because of these continuances.
All right, so let's hear Speaker Ralston giving his side of the story on the House floor. This was from Monday.
I have an obligation not to dismiss their concerns, but to be mindful that the consent of the governed is a vital block in the foundation of our government.
What's he saying there?
So it's a law called legislative leave, and there Speaker Ralston is referring to members of the public and other people that have had questions about this. So the law says that anyone who's in the General Assembly, the House and the Senate, who is a lawyer, can ask for cases to be continued or postponed while the legislature is in session through 3 weeks after adjournment. But there was another provision added a few years back that it's for any sort of legislative duties or things that somebody has to do. Now, a lawmaker who's here from January to April maybe wouldn't have much reason in June or July, but the speaker works year-round with his staff on different legislative things. So basically year-round, he has been asking for these continuances over the course of 2 years. Now, the speaker says that he's going to put together a commission, maybe as soon as today, a bipartisan group of lawyers and lawmakers and other people involved with the legal system to examine how other states do this to figure out how Georgia's law maybe needs to be tweaked, because he says he hasn't done anything wrong or unethical, but perception is reality, and a lot of people have questions about some of these cases that have been brought to light.
And these have been lingering for a long time. This is not the first ethics complaint against Ralston. The state Supreme Court investigated accusations against him for violating bar rules. This was back in 2014. He was reprimanded by the bar for those charges in 2017. He then backed a constitutional amendment remaking the watchdog agency that oversees the judiciary that ended up diminishing, really, the power of the Georgia bar. But so far, Ralston has flexed enough power to keep these ethics complaints from sticking. How about now?
Well, the resolution was filed by Republican Representative David Clark of Buford, and others have signed on, about nine others, so it's not an overwhelming majority. So the resolution's not going to go anywhere to call for the speaker to resign. He says he's not going anywhere. And Representative Clark is going to be one of those people putting his name into the hat to run for Georgia's 7th congressional district, so it's being dismissed as kind of a campaign stunt by Ralston and others. But the bigger picture here are these questions, these ethics complaints, and these other things. A lot of people in the House, both Republican and Democrat, support David Ralston and his leadership and what's going on. So you won't see him resigning or going away anytime soon. And the larger question of ethics complaints and things about the state House and the Senate, it's very hard for someone to file a complaint and for it to stick. You see in the state Senate this session them making the rules harder for somebody to file complaints of sexual harassment against senators. So the legislature is, you know, it's not rife necessarily with people acting unethically, but it does make it difficult to make something stick and make something happen.
In those cases, those charges are made. All right, so let's get to what did happen and got accomplished. Governor Kemp's Medicaid waiver plan passed in the Senate, now in the House. It's called the Patients First Act, and this would allow the governor to seek waivers from Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act. passed along party lines in the Senate. What's the concern for opponents and Democrats?
Well, the Democrats want full Medicaid expansion. They say that it's cheaper, it covers more Georgians, and it's the answer to put insurance cards in the pockets of more people to get reliable health care. But as I've mentioned before, on the flip side, many Republicans who are on Health and Human Services Committee and other places say that Medicaid is a broken system that isn't working for providers and isn't working for Georgians who are on it. So expanding Medicaid willy-nilly without addressing some of the issues with the system might mean people have insurance cards, but no doctors that they're able to go see and no doctors that take it. So this waiver process is the way for the governor to look at targeted areas of expansion, maybe whether it's mental health or maternal mortality or things like that, to grow the pool of people covered without, you know, just opening the floodgates for everything.
All right. Is this likely to pass the House?
Well, the House and the Senate, you know, the House and the Senate are two very different chambers in, you know, how they do things, but also how the allegiances lie. Really, the biggest thing in the Capitol isn't Republican versus Democrat. It's House versus Senate. There are also a lot more members in the House who have a lot more opinions about both the governor and Medicaid and health plans and things. And so this is not going to be one of those bills that everyone pushes the yes button as soon as it comes up for a discussion. So that remains to be seen.
Well, we're getting a little bit of an update on what's going on under the Gold Dome with GPB politics reporter Stephen Fowler. This week, the House did pass a bill that would allow hemp farming in Georgia. 41 states already allow this. What kind of regulations are in place to grow hemp for farmers in Georgia?
So one of the things it does is it creates these 10 processing licenses for farmers or companies or bigger entities to take hemp and turn it into usable stuff. And then there's another category of licenses for growers that farmers can pay. I believe it's $1,000 a year for anyone to be able to grow it. Now, industrial hemp can be used for things like clothing and construction materials and a lot of different things. Other people are interested in it because of the CBD oil in it, which is used for some health reasons and things. And it has a very low THC level. So hemp is not the same as marijuana, or as one Republican representative said in a committee meeting, you could smoke a truckload of it and it's not going to do anything for you. So part of this hemp growing bill and part of this legislative process has been educating the public, the lawmakers, and members of the media the difference between hemp and marijuana.
And
so
we seem to work.
Right. So what we're not going to have is the fields of South Georgia being marijuana grow fields or things like that. Industrial hemp, a lot of people say there's a lot of economic benefits to farmers being able to add that into the rotation.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see what's going on in committee. The Senate Transportation Committee narrowly approved a bill this week that would give the state control of Atlanta's airport. Now, Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottom called it theft from citizens.
And it doesn't serve Atlantans nor Georgia well for us to go down this path. The state and the city of Atlanta have had a very good working and productive relationship over the past several years. And if this goes through, this unilaterally destroys the trust that so much time has been spent building.
So what's her opposition and why so controversial?
Well, so I spoke with the mayor on Wednesday earlier this week when this committee meeting was getting ready to happen, and the city of Atlanta and the mayor is just going all out in opposition to this bill. You know, she mentioned it was a theft from the citizens of the city of Atlanta, and she called multiple reporters and multiple outlets, and that is her line, that this is a theft. So what this would do would create this Georgia Airport Authority that would oversee the Atlanta airport and move it out from under the city of Atlanta. And the senators that filed it and others think that, you know, they've read news reports about problems with vendors and bidding and contracts at the airport and corruption allegations. And they think the state can do it better. But the mayor says the state has shown no evidence it can do things better. She says there's FAA rules that say that the city would have to be okay with that for the state to do it, which they're not. And that really this would be taking resources and taking this crown jewel from the city and giving it to this statewide bureaucracy for no reason. So There's not necessarily any indication that this would make it to the governor's desk, but the mayor and other city leaders are putting on a full court press to make sure that it doesn't even remotely get there.
Okay, and out at the city of Atlanta, Georgia farmers and others still recovering from the devastation of Hurricane Michael. There's a bill in the U.S. Congress that would provide billions in storm relief for our state and others. Here is Georgia Agriculture Commissioner Gary Black.
But there are a significant number of crops in Georgia. Fresh vegetables, $483 million of loss there. $750 million worth of loss in timber. $600 million worth of loss in pecan.
How would this federal money be used to assist Georgia farmers?
Well, so the crops and things that Commissioner Black mentioned are outside of the typical crops that you would think of in Georgia, like peanuts and cotton. And so he said there's never really been a disaster plan for those before. So this federal money, if it comes, would be some sort of block grant for the state to kind of figure out how to use it and the federal government to figure out how to use it to get those farmers and get those benefits that are outside of what we have experience with dealing with before in disaster recovery. So really, it's just a big question mark. But Georgia senators sponsored that act. And, you know, the governor was just in Washington, D.C., trying to lobby for it to get those farmers the money they need.
All right. Got a comment here on Twitter. Steve Brown says, I guess it's a matter of who do you trust the most, the state or the city of Atlanta regarding the airport? Most citizens don't trust either of them. So full court press or not, you get an uphill battle to convince the public. All right, Stephen, Bill, that you a process that you've been following especially closely, overhauling Georgia's elections and voting system. If passed, the Secretary of State would put a bill in out. Would put out a request for new ballot marking devices that create a paper trail. So what did the House have to say about that this week?
Well, the House is still in Republican control, and the House voted for it. There were two Democrats that voted for it and one Republican that voted against it. But the House still had the larger debate and discussion about we need hand-marked paper ballots and not ballot-marking devices. They talked about the cost and the different things like that. And so it's more of the same conversation that we've been having, but now it goes to the state Senate. And the state Senate subcommittee on elections heard the voting bill yesterday. They heard from people over several hours, and it's more of the same discussion. There's a group of citizens that want hand-marked paper ballots. Elections officials who run the elections say they want ballot-marking devices, and the Secretary of State says, you know, ballot-marking devices are the way to go.
So not expecting significant changes to the bill in the Senate?
Not so far.
All right. You also sat down this yesterday with Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to talk about the bill and his time in office. Here's just a clip of him talking about working with the county elections officials.
We don't want to become a top-down ogre like sometimes the federal government is to Georgia, but we want to make sure that we're helping our, you know, friends out there at the county level.
So what's he saying about the bill's progress?
Well, so one of the things is that we have new voting machines that are going to come in, and that's going to require training, and it's going to require training of county elections officials who run things and the volunteer poll workers who help run things on the ground level. So he wants to make sure that the new system, whatever it is understood by everyone in Georgians and understood by the people running things, so there are no questions about how our election system works in the future elections. And then there's the election law part of it. It makes it easier for people to vote, makes the absentee ballot process easier. So his big thing is this bill would make voting different in Georgia, but it would make it easier and better for all involved. Now, not everyone agrees with that, but that's his stance, and that's what this bill's process, which is why there's hours and hours of hearings, so that everyone can feel like their voice is being heard in the process. And you can hear that full interview with him on Monday.
Okay, so likelihood that March is going out like a lamb, a little low right now. But next Thursday is crossover day. That's when bills have to be clear of at least one chamber in order to become law. So it's a big day. GPB TV's State House reporter Donna Lowry is going to be there with you. It's on Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Be right back after a short break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. African Americans are 10% more likely to report experiencing serious mental health problems than their white counterparts. That is according to the Health and Human Services Office of Minority Health. But even when they seek professional help, they may not find caregivers who look like them or who share their experiences. The Therapy for Black Girls podcast aims to remove the stigma from mental health issues, offers resources for Black women on topics from anxiety, body image, to perfectionism.
no matter what you do, a lot of times there is another expectation, right? So you go to school and you get all these degrees, and then the questions are, well, when are you going to be married? And, you know, so I mean, so it feels like every time you hit one of these markers, then there is another marker that people expect you to meet.
Dr. Joy Bradford is host of the podcast, and she's with me on the phone today. Joy, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, you worked as a college counselor. You have your own psychology practice here in Atlanta. You started this blog called Therapy for Black Girls back in 2014. Why'd you start addressing these topics online rather than in the clinical setting?
Well, I've always been doing both. So in my experience on college campuses, it seemed like a lot of the Black women students were not necessarily coming into the counseling center. So it felt important for me to go out to where they were to have these conversations about addressing their mental health. And so in having those conversations, it felt like there were certain themes that were coming up. So I thought having a blog to talk about these things for women beyond the campus I was on would be a really good idea.
So what kind of responses were you getting?
The responses from the very beginning have been incredibly positive and exciting. So when I would mention to people the name of the blog, there would be lots of, ooh, and yes, kind of thing. So it definitely seemed like information that people were ready and willing to accept.
So then you decide to start this podcast. Any models that you were looking at for podcasts about mental health, for what worked or what to avoid?
Not necessarily, but I was already listening to tons of other podcasts about things not mental health related, so lots of like comedy podcasts and pop culture podcasts, and I fell in love with the medium, and so I thought it would be a great way, a great addition to add to Therapy for Black Girls in a way that different kinds of people could get the information, and it has kind of taken off from there.
Well, we're going to bring you back to that very first episode. Here's a clip.
I want sisters to realize that mental health is not just developing strategies to manage panic attacks. It's also about how we can be more assertive, how we can set firmer boundaries, and how we can learn to listen to that little voice inside of us that tells us when something is wrong.
So you're not just responding in a kind of triage way. You're kind of helping to build a foundation for mental health. What was the decision that you made for that approach?
Yeah, I think that has been foundational to my training. So my training is as a counseling psychologist. And in counseling psychology, there is a large focus on prevention and all of the kinds of things that you can do to prevent having a mental health crisis. And so much of my work has been surrounding prevention kinds of things and helping you make healthy decisions along the way so that you don't necessarily get to the crisis level.
But that's all based on the therapeutic relationship, a very one-on-one relationship. And you say at the beginning of each episode, this podcast is not a substitute for a relationship with a therapist. So how is it different handling this private practice face-to-face or maybe even a phone or Skype and this one-to-many where you're speaking to so many?
Yeah, it has been a very different experience, but one that I found that I really love. So even in my history of working on college campuses, the things that I love most were outreach presentations where I would be able to meet with a group of people about a certain topic. And so this kind of feels like an extension of that. And the disclaimer, of course, is necessary because I am licensed. So, you know, people listen to the podcast and they do feel like they have like a relationship with me in their heads, but I need to make sure they understand I'm not actually their therapist, you know, of course, to protect my license and liability issues and stuff. But it is great when I get emails from people that say they listened to a podcast episode and now they're considering going to therapy or that they found a therapist in the directory and they love working with them. So I'm always heartened by those emails from people who are getting positive changes in their lives because of the podcast.
Yeah, I noticed that on your website accompanying the podcast, there is a list of therapists. So what's your criteria? How do you find those people?
It is a self-selection, so people can go on and add their listing. And so most of the therapists in the directory are Black women across the country, and there are over 1,200 therapists in the country right now. So I'm very excited by the way that that list has also grown.
Well, your episodes range from bipolar disorder to allowing vulnerability, I think is the most recent one, toxic masculinity, surviving Valentine's Day. So some things that are, you know, mental health concerns that keep going and going, but then others that are maybe more topical. How do you decide what to focus on in each episode?
So I am in constant conversation with my community. So I'm always soliciting their feedback about what kinds of things they want to hear. So I keep a running list of topics. But I also am a huge like pop culture, TV, movie kind of person. And so anytime I watch something or hear something that I feel like has a mental health slant or can give a message to my community about how they can take better care of themselves, then I also will develop a podcast episode around that.
So with your engagement and dialogue with your listeners, do certain subjects seem to come up over and over again?
Yeah, absolutely. So the bipolar episode was one that was heavily requested. So sometimes, you know, when people get a new diagnosis, there's lots of like, oh my goodness, what does this mean? And so some of those topics have been very highly requested for people wanting to kind of make sense of what the diagnosis means and how do they then move forward with their lives.
So what you normally, I've listened to a couple of episodes, and you normally talk with another therapist or an expert. It's very conversational. It's very, nobody's wagging a finger at anybody here. So how has that evolved?
Yeah, that was always very intentional because, you know, it is a podcast that is for just the regular people, right? Like, it's not necessarily a podcast aimed at other therapists, though I am joined by other therapists a lot. I wanted it to be very conversational. Like, the whole goal of Therapy for Black Girls is to make the information relevant and accessible. And so when I am prepping guests for the podcast, I encourage them, you know, don't use a whole bunch of jargon. You know, talk to people as if you are explaining this to somebody who's young without using, you know, all of these words that we learn in training. Mm-hmm. And so I really want it to be about, you know, getting good information from reputable therapists, but also like allowing all these other therapists to show that we have different kinds of personality. So the purpose of that is to let people see like all therapists are different. And so you may not connect with me, but you may connect with somebody who was on episode 54. And, you know, so you can tell that there are different kinds of people who are going to be a different fit for you, and that it's okay to find the person who feels like the best fit for you.
Well, and I imagine you've tapped into this population that really wants to talk about this stuff. Any listener responses come up for you to episodes that, you know, the personal story, maybe something that you weren't expected that really connected to the subject matter?
I can't think of any off the top of my head, but the most frequent responses that I get are that listening to an episode really helped them understand something better about themselves, or that they didn't even realize that that was something you could talk to a therapist about, which again is the goal, that you don't have to just talk to a therapist when you're in crisis. You can also talk with a therapist about all of these improvements that you would like to make in your lives, and that's why the resources are there.
Now, you've talked about starting this in college populations, and I know millennials are a big part of the target audience here, at least from the subject matter and from the look of the responses. And you've done a number of episodes on anxiety, but polls showing this is an increasing problem in American culture. What are you hearing? What are people worried about? What do they feel anxious about?
A little bit of everything, honestly. You know, and I think a large part of that is because we are so connected by social media. So we get all these alerts about breaking news and, you know, there's some new catastrophe in a part of the country or something is going on. And so I think people are just at a heightened state of arousal right now, which means that they may be struggling with anxiety. So I think there's a lot of anxiety about like politics, about school shootings, about, you know, just different kinds of things. And people are really struggling with like how to make sense of all of that.
We're speaking with the Atlanta psychologist, Dr. Joy Bradford. She's host of the podcast Therapy for Black Girls, which takes on a big stigma. And increasingly, younger generations, I think, understand that seeing a counselor when coping with life issues is like, you know, going to a dentist for a toothache. But this form of care still has a great stigma, especially in older generations, and especially in the African-American community. Seeing a lot of data on African-Americans not as likely to seek therapy as their white counterparts. What do you think is at the root of that?
I think historically there has been a large feeling of what goes on in your house stays in your house. So, of course, if you're not going to talk to the general public about whatever is happening, you would not go to a stranger and tell them your very personal information. So I think a lot of us have been raised to feel that way. But I also think that a large part of it comes related to the Black community's relationship to church and spirituality, and seeing and sometimes believing that if you are struggling with a mental health issue, that it means that you have a weak faith relationship leadership, which of course is not the truth. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very encouraged to see more churches and faith organizations talking about mental health topics and talking about the fact that you can pray and see a therapist. So I think that those are some of the issues that have led to there being an increased stigma in the community.
Do you think there's a perception that therapy is a white people thing?
Oh, yeah, I think a lot of people still feel that way. I think that that is changing, though, again, like you mentioned, with the younger generation. You know, a lot of people are talking about their experiences with therapy who are not white people. So I think that every time somebody shares their experiences with therapy, then it makes it okay for somebody else to see therapy, for people to see, like, oh, this is not only a certain type of person who can go and talk with a therapist.
Back in 2013, the American Psychology Association reported that white counselors make up about 80% of the psychology workforce. So this is in comparison to 5% of African-American counselors. Have you had conversations with your colleagues in the field about these stats and maybe some reasons for those numbers?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of reasons for that. So, you know, one, there is a lot of training that goes on before you can become a therapist. So you do, of course, 4 years of undergrad and then at least 2 years of a master's program and then sometimes maybe 2 to 3 years of additional supervision before you can even practice independently. And so I think for a lot of people that can be a hurdle because, you know, your income may not look like the level of training that you have. So for some people it would be like, okay, I'm going to find something where I can make, you know, independent money much quicker than having to do almost 10 years of, you know, kind of supervised training. And I also think that a lot of graduate programs are not particularly friendly and welcoming for people of color. You know, so grad school is already stressful, but if you add on top of that racist microaggressions that make it more difficult for you to complete your program, then for a lot of people, they will just choose something else.
Given that the majority of counselors currently are white, have you had conversations with white counselors or psychiatrists or psychologists or social workers about how to be more welcoming and maybe accommodating to people of color?
Yeah, I have had conversations, and there are also other colleagues who are doing incredible work around helping white therapists to really get in touch with their biases and what that may look like in the therapy room and how they can, you know, prevent themselves from perpetuating any of these microaggressions against people of color. So I think it's incumbent upon white therapists, though, to make sure that they are doing their work. You know, I think a lot of times, you know, people don't necessarily want to have a conversation around white privilege or how that might look in the therapy room, but it's important that you do. I mean, when you hear these numbers about 80% of them not being, you know, non-white people, then you really need to make sure that you are doing your work so that people of color and black people in particular are not having traumatic experiences in the therapy office.
How about black women in particular? This is your target audience that you're speaking mm-hmm. to. Why do you think, we heard a little clip earlier that a woman that you were speaking to, I'm not sure if she was a therapist or not, but said, you know, like we have this idea that we're not strong if we ask for help. Why do mm-hmm. you think it's particular for black women?
Yeah, that has been a very long-held stereotype in the black community. And again, I think most stereotypes start from a place of where it kind of makes sense and then it doesn't anymore. You know, so if we just kind of go back through generations when we talk about people who were enslaved and families being separated, like lots of women had to kind of make sure they were taking care of the household. And so I think some of that has kind of just trickled down to black women being seen as infallible and that we can never make mistakes and we always have to kind of be on point. But the amount of pressure that that adds to us and the increased anxiety and stress is just not, you can't keep up at that pace. And so I think continuing to have conversations around the fact that we are human, we're not superhuman. I mean, there's a whole, you know, term around black girl magic and what all of that means. And as incredible and wonderful as we are, we also need to be making sure that we're allowing ourselves to be human and to understand that we don't always have to be on.
Mm-hmm. So, how does somebody, you know, if you have a woman come into your office, she's never been there before, she's never been in therapy before, how do you begin to kind of break down that idea that, you know, it doesn't mean you don't have magic if you're not, mm-hmm. if you're here?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I do a lot around like educating what the therapy process is, because I think for anybody who's never been to a therapist's office, it can feel very intimidating and you don't know what happens behind these closed doors. And so I think it's really important to do a lot of education about what the process looks like, what are the confines of confidentiality, letting them know that it's not typically a very quick fix. So I do understand that you may be struggling with something in particular, but it may even feel worse before it feels better. So really doing a lot of prep work to help them understand the process so that they feel more understanding and welcome in the space.
Mm-hmm. How do you think race bias plays into therapy sessions? You know, somebody who comes in and they may feel like they're immediately not understood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and I have heard those sentiments from lots of different women who have tried to go to therapy. And it is very unfortunate because then it becomes more difficult for them to try a new therapist, because who wants to kind of keep telling that story? But I think it has come out in the ways of people not necessarily being believed or asking lots of follow-up questions that make you feel like you're under a microscope as opposed to this person is really just trying to hear my story. So I think that, again, as therapists, we do need to be aware of, you know, like, what kinds of biases we have that may inform the questions that we're asking and the different kinds of diagnostic impressions that we may even be having.
Well, as the therapists say, our time is up. Joey Bradford, she's an Atlanta psychologist. There's much more information on her practice and on her podcast, Therapy for Black Girls. That's at our website, gppnews.org. Little update, a comment here from Darren Duke on Twitter said the Atlanta airport, well, it's not even in the city of Atlanta. Clayton, Fulton, and College Park all have a say, and they need to have a say in the area that they are affected the most. City of Atlanta politicians never have to face a voter who has a plane fly 100 feet over their house. Keep those comments coming. We're at OST Talk. President Trump's longtime personal attorney Michael Cohen blasted his former employer in front of the House Oversight and Reform Committee this week. While pundits and social media chew over the content of his testimony and how it's affecting the White House, we're talking about how it looked and what that means. And this is what Patty Wood does. She's among the top three nonverbal communication and human behavior experts who consults for companies all over the world, and she's based right here in Atlanta. Patty, thank you so much for coming in.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. After Michael Cohen testified to a closed session in the Senate on Tuesday, sworn testimony on the House floor on Wednesday, televised, everybody could watch. So what are you looking for in an event of this magnitude?
I'm looking for performance rather than authenticity. I'm looking for how anger is used by both the representatives and the witnesses. And specifically, I'm looking to see whether they're telling the truth.
What are some of the telltale signs if someone's telling the truth or not?
Well, actually, one of the major things is something I was looking for in Cohen, and you saw it actually in his opening remarks, synchronicity. It means that they're telling the truth because the information is coming from their limbic system. So it's a feel, show, say. Somebody feels something, you see it authentically in their body language, you hear it in their paralanguage, that's their voice tone, tempo, and speaking rate, and then the words come out. And you saw that in his opening testimony. He had a very definitive voice, small, slight, jerky head movements, but the movements came before the words. Mm. So you know it's authentic, it's not coming from the neocortex. To give you an example, if somebody is lying, one of the tells could be that they say the words and then all of a sudden they smile or have the facial expression that goes with them.
Aha, uh-huh. Like, so it follows the
right.
words that
so,
come out.
I love you so much. And then they smile.
But you said, all right, I want to get into this difference between performance and authenticity. I mean, this is a man who's been a trial lawyer in his
yes.
life. He's been a lawyer for a long time. So performance is probably part of what he does.
He's very good.
Right. So what? How do you do?
Well, he did very well. He used anger well. Anger is something I see all the time in congressional testimony. It's always amazing to me that people can shout and scream in that setting. And his opening testimony, he was angry, definitely angry.
What communicated anger?
The upward raised voice, very, very loud. He did a lot of forward movements. Actually, that speaks to authenticity because it's very hard to move forward with your head, with your upper torso, with your gestures when you're lying because you're in retreat. You don't want to be seen or found out, so you tend to go backwards or stay still. How indignant he was, there might have been a little performance in that, but his delivery style, there were things he couldn't fake that were authentic.
Well, here's a little bit when Congresswoman Jackie Speier, she's a Democrat from California, was questioning him about threatening people on behalf of Donald Trump.
How many times did Mr. Trump ask you to threaten an individual or entity on his behalf?
Quite a few times.
50 times?
More.
100 times?
More.
200 times?
More.
500 times?
Probably.
So we're not seeing him right now. Neither is the audience.
But you're hearing the paralanguage. And if you noticed how quickly he responded, so he's in the moment, and that typically speaks of honesty.
Well, you talked about retreat. There was a lot of, it appeared to be humility, a lot of vulnerability in his testimony. Did you see that? Or was am I fooled?
Yes and no. He was really good at being that way. Actually, one of the most telling moments to me is when he was asked about collusion, Trump and collusion. And you saw a marked difference from his persona that had been very angry, very definitive, loud. Suddenly, his body went down like he was a turtle retreating. He got this little boy affect and he slowed down. He hemmed and hawed and paused and very much, I have no idea what you're talking about, as if he was a stupid, innocent little boy. And it was such a radical change, and it happened so quickly. And he was so thoughtful and careful and correcting the representative who was asking him in that testimony. He would get it down to the word, this, that, where you could see underneath the little boy was this lawyer who was well prepared for that line of questioning.
You talked about the anger on the part of those who are asking for the testimony as well. I mean, that it's funny that you rarely see members of the House or Senate as pugnacious as they are in that case.
Well, it's a performance for America. It's a performance for their constituents, for the people that may or may not vote for them if they don't appear strong and forceful. What's interesting to me is that their delivery was that way, but many of them didn't look very prepared.
Huh.
As well.
So do you think that's a cover?
I think it's a cover.
You mean if they're not well prepared, it's like get them with bombast instead of information?
Well, I think they've gotten away with that for a long time, and now it's clear. And we saw some representatives be very prepared. In fact, several of the women representatives were very prepared in their line of questioning.
Huh. That's something to note.
Yes. And who was listening? To me, I would love to get all the representatives in a training class and I could teach them, here's how you detect deception. Here's how you follow up with a question when you're not getting an answer and somebody's evading. But part of that's being a really good listener. And there was very few good listeners asking questions yesterday.
Well, there were lots of Republican ammo against his credibility, which, of course, this happens in trials all the time or testimonies that the prosecutor or the defense attorney, whatever it may be, is doing their best to undermine his credibility. And certainly he has some strikes against his credibility. But here is Michael Cohen's response many hours in after this has happened.
I just find it interesting, sir, that between yourself and your colleagues, that not one question so far since I'm here has been asked about President Trump. That's actually why I thought I was coming today, not to confess the mistakes that I've made. I've already done that, and I'll do it again every time you ask me about taxes or mistakes. Yes, I made my mistakes. I'll say it now again, and I'm going to pay the ultimate price. But I'm not here today, and the American people don't care about my taxes. They want to know what it is that I know about Mr. Trump. And not one question so far has been asked about Mr. Trump.
That's President Trump's longtime personal attorney, Michael Cohen, of course, testifying on Wednesday in front of the House Oversight and Reform Committee. We're getting a different kind of read of this with Patty Wood. She's among the world's top nonverbal communication and human behavior experts. Okay, so what are you hearing there?
Well, I think one thing to remark on is that he was noticing. He noticed he wasn't asked a single question about that. And I think he was probably well prepared to say that statement. It was a powerful, powerful talking point.
Mm-hmm.
And you could feel the frustration in his voice. That was authentic. That was really coming from his heart and made him very sympathetic to me in that moment as well.
So did you think you can really turn something around with something like that? I mean, does one think that... Is that a sign that he thinks, I'm really calling you all in the carpet?
Well, isn't that an interesting viewpoint for him to have? Throughout the testimony, he was calling them on what they weren't and were doing. And that's an interesting lawyer tactic not everybody can get away with. again, so interesting that he would go back and forth through so many emotions. Also interesting to me because in testimony like this, some people only see 50 seconds of the whole day. So you could have a totally different viewpoint on whether he was honest and authentic or whether he was bombastic or he was a little stupid boy and didn't know what was going on just from a small piece of footage. So you really have to, in my work, you have to look at all of it. You have to look at the context. You have to know what I call baseline of that person and how he normally interacts to see, is this man telling the truth?
So, Patty, is that something that you do, that you are, that you look at witnesses in court cases or depositions and say they're telling the truth or they're
right? So if there's an interrogation video, ideally you want to get baseline of what their normal is. Even if I'm doing a murder case, I want to see if their home, is there something on Facebook? Is there any footage of them in normal settings so I can see what their normal is? You're also going, what would be normal for other people in those circumstances? So for Cohen, I was comparing all the congressional hearings that I've analyzed over the decades and comparing the way he was handling it with everybody else that had been in that bad seat. I call that, you know, it's a castle wall. They're all in the castle wall judging him and asking him questions.
Looking down.
Right, and he's in the moat with the alligators. Mm-hmm. It's just a bad position to be in, and how do they handle it? And most use anger.
Well, it's interesting that you said comparing it to normal behavior, because we've seen Michael Cohen many times on television, you know,
right,
speaking to a press scrum. And he was accused by many of the Republican representatives of, you know, you're just doing this to grandstand. You're doing this for, you want to sell a book, you want to sell a movie, that kind of thing. What is normal, I guess, is the question. And do you get asked by somebody who's going to be a potential witness for something to kind of coach them on this is what normal looks like?
I can't coach somebody who's going to testify in court because that there's danger in doing that.
Okay, but how about a talk show or something like that?
Yeah, I coach people that are going to be in front of the media. I have coached people who are going to testify before Congress as well. And in that preparation, what I look for is what is their natural? What is their baseline? What feels comfortable and at ease for them? How do they communicate their authenticity? Are they fast? Are they slow? Are they loud? Are they soft? Because I want them to be the best them, rather than teaching them to fit into a particular mold, because you want them to be honest. You want them to be authentic. I might also teach people how to deliver certain talking points with more power or verve as well.
Well, during his closing statement, Michael Cohen, interesting, he was speaking directly to the president, I think. You know, he
yes,
was saying,
he was.
Like, you don't want to be this person. You have a choice. You don't
yes.
have to do that. But Representative Cummings, Elijah Cummings, did the closing remarks, and this is what he had to say.
I don't know whether they believe you, but the fact is that you come, you have your head down, and this has got to be one of the hardest things that you could do. I know that you are worried about your family, but this is a part of your destiny.
Now, after holding firm, you know, going through those permutations that you talked about, he openly wept. At this point, he cried.
Yes.
Was it just relief? What do you think was happening for him?
Tears can be a cover cue. So you have to be really careful. And I do in my analysis of tears. But it's hard for anybody to imagine how difficult that kind of testimony is. So it seemed authentic release to me. And his closing testimony, where he made so many accusations towards Trump, I don't know if you noticed the last thing he said was, "This is not you." There was this intimate moment where he's accusing the president that he had this intimate relationship with for a decade with, of all these bad things, but he wanted to say, "But that's not you. You're not really that way." I think there is that moment when he's crying where he realized, yes, Trump is that way. And that's a horrible thing to have to know, that you believe somebody, you trusted somebody, you worked for somebody, and they were a monster.
Patty Wood, she is one of the world's top three nonverbal communication and human behavior experts right here in Atlanta. Well, that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Alec Caslow is our engineer, Don Smith, our dean of grammar, and Amy Kiley, senior producer. We always love to hear from you. We're on Facebook and we're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. This is On Second Thought.